Let me just tell you this. Salt came at a time politically when it's important to know that the miners you saw, the people who were in the local there, were zinc miners. They were in New Mexico, and zinc was an important commodity not only for peace but especially for war. And there was a situation where we were constantly working against terrible odds. Filmmaking is a tough craft. It's an artful craft, and it's very enriching. I'm talking now in terms of personal values, not in terms of money. But we were confronted by airplanes flying overhead carrying messages to us saying that we were sons of bitches and we would be destroyed, and the work would never be seen, and things of that nature. We had trucks of colleagues from the trade union movement in California. On the border, we used the private property in order to avoid some of these confrontations. And they'd have trucks there with loudspeakers calling us names and denigrating us and telling us what fools and idiots we were and that how we were never going to work again and so forth and so on. The Congress of the United States was notorious in its charges of anarchy, of deceit and corruption on the part of the company, which was totally untrue. It was a bloody time, let me tell you so. And I remember at one point, and I will tell you this one anecdote, and I hope that you will realize that this was only one of a number, but I had received a telephone call. Mr. Biverman was a man who very often retired early with his copy of the screenplay, or the script, to decide what he thought the next day's shooting should be, or the next 2-3 days. And very often he would then call me at some point before the evening was over, and we would confer together. And then very often if we needed a mob scene, shall we say, I'd have to remind Mr. Biverman that we didn't have central casting on the New Mexican border. Therefore, if I was to get 40 or 50 or 100 people, it would be very tough to do it overnight. Most of these people did not have telephones, and the others who did very often had jobs a mile down in a zinc mine. So there were problems which we had which were not typical of filmmakers. On one particular occasion, toward the end of our schedule, although we were quite concerned, we had a number of interruptions. Rosaura Rovaltis came back. I will tell you of one incident. Came back. We came back from a shooting one afternoon, and I was in the front car. And as I arrived in the lodge where we was living, which was 15 miles outside of Silver City, New Mexico. Silver City, it was famous before Salt of the Earth was made there because of Billy the Kid, who was born there. And outside of that, nobody ever heard of Silver City except for the zinc miners. But there was a male and a female guard of official sitting in the lounge of our residence. And I went up to them, I asked them whether there was something I could do for them. And they said, "We're looking for Ms. Rovaltis. We're charging her with violating her entrance authority." And she was arrested. And we had about 4 weeks, 3.5 to 4 weeks of shooting to go, and she was taken in a car to the border. They didn't throw her over the border, they held her incommunicado in a hotel near the border for the 10 days that it took the lawyers for the company out of Los Angeles to attempt to secure her release. They never succeeded. The federal judge refused to hear their case, and they threw her over the border as an illegal immigrant. She had paid all her fines and she was working legitimately for an American motion picture company, but that made no sense as far as the government was concerned. By the time she was removed from the United States, there were still about half a dozen scenes, close-ups in the main, which had yet to be done, and they were done in a Mexican hotel room within the next month or so. On one particular night, that shortly after this event took place, I was with the camera crew that was preparing themselves for the next day. The cameramen, as a general rule, do get their reels worked or lined up for the next day in advance, the night before. So they're ready to move out at 7:30 in the morning, and they don't have to start putting their film in the camera. And I received a telephone call from a voice I'd never heard before saying we were all going out in black boxes if we were not out of the county in 24 hours. Now, we had had a lot of attacks, we had had a lot of threats up to that point. But this was the first threat, although I had heard from a priest that I had, who had befriended me and I had befriended him, a drinking man in Mexican bars, a very interesting human being, but who was a priest nonetheless, but who said to me at one point, he called me up the night that I received this threat. And that threat, by the way, appeared, and I don't know if we have the piece, the newspaper headlines. It may not be convenient for you. But the major newspapers of Los Angeles, of California, and Texas, and New Mexico, had major headlines above the masthead saying the motion picture company was going out in black boxes. I took that threat that night seriously. Biberman was already in bed and probably asleep, and I decided that I couldn't afford to run the risk of disclosing to my colleagues that there was a threat hanging over us, because if I had, many of them would have jumped in their cars the following morning and they would have been vanished within an hour. So I went in search of the priest, and I had found the priest, and I won't go into all the details except to tell you that I found him in a Mexican bar, drinking alone, under a spotlight, wearing a Knights of Columbus jacket, and he was drinking Boilermakers. And he said to me, I have read your script and it's wonderful, and I will do anything I can to help you, except I would not give you any guns. I said, Father, I didn't come here to ask you for guns. I'm going to ask you for your blessing, of course, for the company and so forth. And he said, I'm going to tell you something. He said, I'm the enemy of the Anglos in this community. I support the Mexicans. I said, why do you support the Mexicans? You yourself are an Anglo. He said, well, because he said, 2 years ago, he said, I got rip-roaring drunk. You see, he said, I like Boilermakers. And he said, I got rip-roaring drunk, I took my clothes off, and I ran naked through the streets carrying the Blessed Virgin. He said, naturally, he said, I spent 2 days in jail, but it's very embarrassing for the community to put the major priest in church in jail. So they let me out, but they let me out with a bail that was paid by the Mexicans, not by the Anglos. The Anglos wanted me out of here as fast as I could get out. But he remained in the community, and he was an important person who said to me the night he heard that we had gotten a threat, and he said, I'm aware of this threat. There are 150 men a few nights ago swore on the Bible to kill you all. So I took it seriously, and I called members of my mill who were down the road a piece. I said, you guys better get over here. I've just had a major threat on the telephone. I had had a suggestion that something was about to happen from the priest himself, who called, when he called me up, he said, this is Alexander and the Fat Boy. I must tell you that in all the years that I knew this man, and for 30 years since then, I have not ever been able to figure out how he ever got away with that bit of jargon. The fact of the matter is, he said to me, Later he said, I expect trouble. But he said, if you don't have police protection, he said, I will sit in the first car with a loaded revolver, which I have, which nobody in the community knows I have, and I will shoot, I swear to you, I will shoot to the death any son of a bitch who takes a pot shot at you. Well, I was dealing with a most unusual human being, of course, and when he said to me, do you think you have some way of getting the troopers here? Well, the only way I could get the troopers there was by calling Mine Mill, which was had their of this local that were down the road. And they came over, it was about 10 o'clock at night. I said, I received a threat on the telephone. We were all going out in black boxes. That is safe. We weren't out of the state within 24 hours. Well, I knew we couldn't get out of the state in 24 hours. I mean, unless we just left everything, abandoned everything, and fled in our cars. So a trio from the Union came over. I told them the story, and I said, we're confronted by a serious problem. Biberman is in bed with his script. Everybody else is probably going to bed. It was now about 10:30, 11 o'clock, and normally we're up at 5 o'clock. And they said, we're going to call the governor. I must tell you that to this day, I don't know the governor's name. I must have blocked it out almost the moment I heard it. Anyway, they called the governor, who was asleep, and he said, I can't, he said, why are you fellows calling me at this hour of the night? And he said, well, we've just gotten, the film company has gotten a threat. We have a vested interest in this picture. We're part of this picture. Our people are playing leading roles in this picture. And if these people are injured or hurt in any way, we will hold you, Governor, responsible. He said, you awaken me, talk to me tomorrow morning. And they said, no, sir, we're talking to you tonight. We're in deadly earnest. We're prepared to place our lives on the line. We want full military police protection by 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. And the governor said, supposing I don't agree. They said, then, Governor, we will remove all 10,000 miners from the state of New Mexico, all from the mines of New Mexico, and arm them. And if you want revolution in this state, sir, you're asking for it. By 8 of the next morning, we had 300 police there, armed, you thought, for military intervention in some foreign country. And we were able to complete a good deal of the film in those next few days by working day and night. Fortunately, although it was a frightening time, most of the crew remained loyal to the project and sustained their work situation. Later, when the film was finally processed and was given to the editors, that was who had headquarters in the Beverly Hills, in the hills of Beverly Hills. What had happened was that they discovered that sometimes scenes would be missing or scenes cut out of work which they had been working on. And they were able eventually to find out that one of the editors that we had employed inadvertently was an agent for the FBI. And so what we're talking about is an unorthodox way to make movies. I don't recommend to anybody in this room that they try to go into the motion picture business with these kind of problems. The film, coming back to the experience of putting this picture together, the film, we had problems, we were confronted, I would say, legitimately, perhaps three or four times, by mobs led by the district attorney of Silver City, and ranchers who had ranches within a radius of, say, 25 to 50 miles, who would participate in holding us accountable for one thing or another. In the beginning, when I first arrived in Silver City, I was able to do business as a production executive simply by walking into stores or walking into banks or walking wherever one does to do business and simply signing papers and saying, we promise to pay and so forth, and that was good enough for them. Within 30 days of that time, I could no longer walk the streets and do business on my signature or on my goodwill. I had to carry as much as $10,000 around with me from one day to the next and to buy things for the company with cash. And very often, I was admitted through a back door. Now, these are the things that happened in the United States of America in the 1950s, and I hope they never happen again. I point out that the value, I think, of Salt of the Earth, not only because it does reflect, it reflects, I think, not only a time in this country, which was difficult for a lot of people, and a lot of people failed to survive. There were a lot of people, as you know, that were arrested. A lot of people served time in jail. Some people died from the inability to deal with the ugliness of personal relationships at that time. And they were really tough for a lot of people. But the fact that the film was made, the fact it never made a dime, it may today have begun to recoup, I would think. I haven't had occasion to talk to anybody who controls the film. That was a small film organization of business people who were created to help finance the motion picture. This film costs relatively no money. In terms of what a feature film costs today, let me tell you, I know from personal experience, the average film today in Hollywood is $20 million. That's an average. It can go as high as 30 and 40 and as low as 6 or 7. But the fact is, this film was made, I think, in cash outlay for less than $400,000. And a lot of that was probably borrowed and maybe never paid back. I don't know. Anyway, the film itself, I think, and I hope you will agree, is a film that talks not only about the value of the trade union movement and the question of what is just and right in a tradition of the labor history of this country, but I think more important for ordinary people is the fact that it's talking about human beings, men and women, husbands and wives, and the failure to be responsible for one another. I think the film carries an immense weight, and I know from my experience with this film, having been shown to university audiences all over the United States, it never fails to have an impact. It never fails to educate. And I guess that's what good filmmaking is all about. Appreciate you for coming.